Leftovers, Season 1, Episode 5, Gladys is over, but we are just getting started talking about the fifth hour of HBO and Damon Lindelof's The Leftovers, because it is, of course, July 2014, nearly August 2014, as I say these words, alongside my co-host here on the Leftovers podcast on Post Show Recaps, a very new podcast network that we just launched. Truly, it's the great, or I assume he's going to be great. I don't know. We are just really getting to know each other. Antonio Mazzaro. Hi, Antonio.
Hi, Josh. It's nice to talk to you again.
Mazzaro, that's with two R's and one Z?
Not quite. It's two Z's and
one R. Oh, okay.
Yep. That's okay. We're just getting to know one another, so it's
just
all good.
Starting to figure it out. Yeah, I mean, we're talking about, The Leftovers today, but that's not all that Antonio and I are podcasting about with each other in this, the year of our post-show recaps, Lord, 2014. That's 2014. 2014. Antonio, of course, we are also talking about Lost on the Lost Lives podcast.
We are
celebrating the 10th anniversary of the launch of Lost.
May I ask, it must be a real joy for you to get to podcast about Lost. I know this is one of your favorite shows of all time. So
yeah.
I know for the people listening, you have to be very happy to finally have the opportunity to podcast about it.
Yeah, I mean, because I think that to do a full spoiler-filled rewatch podcast of every single episode of Lost would just be too much.
It really feels like a waste of time, yeah.
Feels like, don't waste your breath podcasting about every single episode of Lost someday with Mike Bloom. So we're doing Lost Lives instead in this, the year 2014. And of course, Antonio, we're also talking about, this is our Damon Lindelof show that we're podcasting about, but we're also currently here in 2014 podcasting about a show from another of Lost's co-creators, Carlton Cuse, The Strain, Antonio.
Strigoi? I think that's what they say on the show. Is that what they call the vampires?
Yeah.
That's right. That is a strain. Some people were going smooth, I think, is what recently happened there, which is a horrifying experience. And that may be why our friend Rob Cesternino decided to drop out and talk about the strain, the going smooth of it all. I really like the character Zach on the strain. I'm really looking forward to seeing.
Yeah, I hope that actor stays in place.
The actor should stay in place because he's very good for a child actor. And I think there's a lot of room for sympathy with the character. So I'm excited, but I don't want to spoil too much about the show. I'm sure we'll be talking about it forever.
All right. Well, Antonio, I'm very excited about the shows that we're podcasting about here in 2014, the first year of post-show recaps, which I can't imagine is ever going to end. I think post-show recaps is going to be a thing that lasts forever.
As long as there are shows, there will be a period after the shows. And as long as there's a period after the shows, people will be talking about them. And so they'll probably be looking for recaps of said shows. So, yeah,
like
it does make
slightly
sense.
Slightly less than 10 years from now, no chance this podcast is going to be closing in on the end of the line.
I wouldn't think so. No. I think it's a thing that could go on forever, for sure.
Could go on forever. Yeah. We could go on forever about all of the various things that we've got going on right now in 2014. But I think that people are going to be really upset if we do not talk about the fifth episode of HBO's The Leftovers. It's Gladys. And hey guys, Josh Wigler here. It's March 27th, 2024.
They got you on that thing called God's Tongue?
Yeah, I'm on God's Tongue right now, folks. And so listen, that was a couple of things that Antonio and I said back in July 2014 when we were about to record our recap of The Leftovers episode Gladys, season one, episode five. But the recording got mangled, completely destroyed. And as a result, there is no Gladys episode of the Leftovers podcast, which is indeed the podcast through which so many of the other shows that Antonio and I would go on to talk about, Mr. Robot, Better Call Saul, Ted Lasso, and so on and so forth, would not have been possible if not for the friendship that was born among the suddenly departed. And Antonio, over the years, we have heard from our Leftovers brethren. And every once in a while, everyone seems to be very appreciative of the show, very appreciative of the podcast, as appreciative, I know, as you and I are of having done it ourselves.
They're good podcasts, Josh.
But every once in a while, we do just like get a knock on the door. That's like, where's the Gladys episode of the Leftovers podcast?
We do get that for some strange reason.
Every once in a
while.
There's
a knock on the door. Thankfully, not a flaming bag waiting there for us when we open it.
Every once in a while, someone knocks on the door and says, hey, did you not recap Gladys? And we're like, folks, that was 10 years ago or seven or whatever it is at the time that we get a message like that. But I do believe, Antonio, that this probably has bothered us as much as it bothered those people who would reach out about missing the episode of Gladys. So here in, a shock to the July 2014 Josh Wigler, in these final few days of post-show recaps, as it's about to end, Antonio, the great Antonio in the sky, we are here to provide a Gladys podcast.
Yes, we are the gladdest gentlemen in the world. We are so happy to be able to do this. We have joked about it a ton. We've not joked about it a ton. We've taken it very seriously a ton. Yes. We've joked about it a ton. You're right. It has been, for both of us, a thing that we have thought about and that we have both marked and said, you know, at some point we're going to go back and we're going to fix that. We're going to do the Gladys podcast and finish our coverage of the Leftovers. We're going to go back through using whatever kind of machine we can find to go back to 2014 and relive that space. So that's what we are bound to do.
So that's what we're bound to do. We are releasing this podcast at a normal point in time in the real time of releasing it. But in the future, I am going to go back through a machine and backdate this episode of the podcast so that it goes immediately between episodes 4 and 6 of The Leftovers season 1, Antonio, because I'm sick like that. And that's what I want to do. And if you're one of those people now that's listening to this podcast in consecutive order and you now have realized, oh, gosh, this is a message from the future. Oh, gosh. This is a message from people who have watched the entire Leftovers. They're going to spoil it for me. I'm watching it one episode at a time. You can hit pause right around now and come back to us once you're done with the entirety of the Leftovers, because Antonio and I are going to talk about that whole thing on the other side of a quick commercial break. Stay tuned. Just kidding. We're not doing commercial breaks anymore, but there was a swoosh.
I'm just so happy that we get the opportunity to do it. If you have not yet stopped and you have not hit pause and you're still watching The Leftovers the first time through, stick with it. That's all I can say. Stick with it. The podcasting will get better. The show will get a lot better. The podcasting will get a lot better. Let's be real.
The audio quality improves.
The audio quality improves. I think the content, I'd like to think the content quality improves a little, at least a little, but the audio quality improves vastly. I think I must have been podcasting using a clock radio speaker.
I think I was using my headset that I was going to be using for
gaming,
the Evolution of Strategy. No. Ah. Or maybe it may even predate the Evolution of Strategy headset. Haven't gone back and listened to that, but gosh, I can't imagine. For a variety of reasons, I can't imagine going back and listening to that.
I went back and listened to some of our Leftovers podcast from 2014, and I thought to myself, boy, I don't want to do this entirely. Like, I don't want to go through and relive 10 years ago, because I'm sure I'm saying some things that I don't agree with anymore, that I would regret, that I would like to delete, et cetera, et cetera. So we live on forever.
We live on forever. We're calling this the Leftovers season 1, episode 5, Gladys recap, ostensibly as a trolling, but it would not be a Wigler Mazzaro production if we did not do our homework for the trolley occasion. Antonio. We are sort of like we're kind of like the guilty remnant of podcasters in the sense that we're willing to go through great lengths to make our point. But we are exactly unlike the guilty remnant in that we talk way too freaking much.
Hey, we want them to remember something they want to forget, Josh.
That's right. That's right.
We want them to remember these shows and our voices, even if they want to forget them.
That's correct. But in order to do this podcast, because Antonio and I weren't just going to come onto the podcast and do the leftovers as a lark, this was a really sacred show for both of us. I'm not misspeaking for you, I don't think, Antonio.
You are not. Absolutely not.
Yeah, I think this is a show that was really important for us, not just as podcasters, but as friends. Like, Antonio and I don't podcast all the time together like we used to once upon a time, but you're like among my very most spoken to human beings in my life. And through this show, like, I found not just a friend, but like a brother from another mother. So coming back to this show that was the origin point of our friendship, let alone our working relationship, meant that we needed to like come correct. And in that spirit, Antonio, in the past, what, week and a half?
Yeah, 2 weeks, somewhere like that, 2 weeks at most.
We've gone back and rewatched the entirety of The Leftovers.
And listened to the audiobook and rewatched the first 5 episodes again.
That part is Antonio. Those second two things is just him.
Fair enough.
You also went back and you listened to some of our podcasts,
yes,
which I could not stand to do, was not able to go.
Honestly, that was the most difficult part.
I'm sure.
No cap. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I'm sure.
Which is not something I would have said in 2014.
But no, it was so fun to do this. And I was so glad that we decided, okay, well, if we're sending off post-show recaps, let's send it off at least partly with one of the shows that matters the most to us, being The Leftovers. And it was an excuse to go back and watch a show that I had not rewatched since it ended. Spoilers at this point are fully fair game for anything that happens in The Leftovers past Gladys. So if you're still hanging out, now is sort of your last call to leave. Antonio, had you gone back and watched The Leftovers at all, or maybe sporadically? This doesn't seem like this was one of your comfort shows from all of our conversations over the years.
No offense to anyone who it is a comfort show for. I cannot imagine that, because it is a discomfort show, if that's a thing, if that exists. It's a challenging show. It's a show that makes you feel and wants you to feel. And that's sort of what the whole crux of season one and the conflict with the guilty remnant is about. And this show does not want us to not feel. So no, it's not something I go back and revisit. Of course, I've rewatched International Assassin more than once. And of course, I rewatched seasons one and two multiple times in the run up to season three. But the important thing is I had not rewatched season three. I had not revisited the finale. All of that was new turf for me. And it was fresh enough in memory that I was being triggered by things like the dog apocalypse, and remembering all of those fun
BBA.
Things.
About.
The BBA. Yes, all of it. All of it. So no, I have not gone back on season three, especially until just now.
Yeah, the BBA hits differently when you know that he is just like a lunatic who's going to get shot in the head at some point.
Yeah, by Tommy Garvey. It's really rough. It's really rough.
Full spoilers for the people who really haven't gotten the bit yet. We really had to tell you it was a bit.
Hey, listen, if we're going to spoil them on anything.
That Tommy Garvey makes it to season three, some people might be shutting off the podcast.
Yes. What is he up to, by the way? I was thinking that as I was rewatching.
Chris Zilka? I have no idea. I was thinking about that as well.
I haven't seen
him. Yeah. So this was your first time going back. Same here. First time going back. What was very fun for me was realizing that there were certain moments that, even though I hadn't watched in, gosh, when did the show ended? Something like 8-ish years ago at this point, 7 or 8 years ago at this point, I think. And there were just scenes that I remembered so vividly, line by line, and not even just like the most iconic stuff, like the unique biometrics of it all. but although that was fairly iconic, but even just like the exact beats when Kevin Sr. is going to come out and say, "What are you ladies up to?" And you're going to, bookmark that in your mind. And in the very next episode, you're going to remember that the next thing that happens on the other side of him saying that is he just gets trank darted instantly. So many great little moments. The vibes of The Leftovers remain immaculate.
Immaculate.
Just like absolutely. It was, it's weird to say that watching this show about severe depression and mental health was a joy to revisit on this rewatch, Antonio, but I was just smiling ear to ear for so much of it. Maybe not during the credits sequences in the first season.
You hate that first season credit intro
so bad. The music on that is so bad, which is hilarious because the music on this show is so good by and large. And also that the season two and beyond credits are going to be, I think, thought about amongst people who I talk TV with, certainly as among the very best opening credits to any prestige TV show. And yet I would say that the opening credits of season one are among the very worst of all the shows that I adore. I think it's maybe number one.
I'd love to hear what else are there in the top five of that list at some point, but I definitely agree. And I agree more about the season two and three. I think elite of the elite for sure. And look, season two is one song and it's a new intro, but that song is a mission statement, and it's a mission statement that shows a show that when we examine it in season two, it has the kind of bravery that you can't even imagine, right? Like it begins with the Axis Mundi scene and the flashback to however many hundreds of years before into a town that we know nothing about. And we follow some of our main characters there, but we really don't get to see him until later into it's just crazy that and that credit sequence is representative of what a mission statement that season is and the bravery it has. And then of course, season three, we were talking about this via text, doing things that I don't think I've seen another show do in terms of using a different song with the same video for each one, and that song being its own mission statement about the episode. Yep. I just love this show so much.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite use of the opening credits in season three?
I mean, I love the Richard Cheese personal Jesus. I don't know why. And I also really love the Gravediggers, 1-800-SUICIDE, even though it's so dark because that episode is so dark in that vein. And it's so heavily about that subject. So those two things really stand out to me. What about you?
I think that the eerie French whispering over episode five, it's a Matt world. Still messes with me because on the immediate other side of that is a nude Frenchman who's about to
engage in some calisthenics,
yoga fire the missiles into the middle of an island in the Pacific Ocean that is housing a Godzilla egg,
some kind of kaiju situation.
I totally can buy that in that writer's room there were actual conversations about whether or not this guy was crazy or onto something. I don't think that The Leftovers ends in any kind of way that makes me feel like maybe one of the things about The Leftovers that doesn't play the best in the long view is like, hey, maybe these very obviously disturbed and upset people have a point. And maybe let's just drown them and wash the point out. It's like, I don't know that that's the way that we want to solve this person's health crisis, but that seems to be how we do it in the world of The Leftovers. So maybe the naked nuclear Frenchman was right, is all that I have to say, at least as per the show.
It's just a fascinating show that it takes place or kicks off from a very simple premise. Like, what happens if 2% of the world's population were to just simply disappear without any kind of rhyme or reason, without any explanation? It would throw all of our systems into upheaval across the globe. And it would throw all of our, our beliefs, the things that we rely on, the things that we use, our systems, our forms of government, our religions, all of it would be tested by this. In season one, the show gets into this a little bit and it teases around the edges of this, but we don't really expand the show. We stay in the small town of Mapleton. And even though we do that in Jarden in season two, I think we expand the world of the show more. And then of course in season three, we're in Australia. Yeah. We're in, the middle of the country. We're talking about global locations. People are moving around constantly. And I think we really do start to see the strain of a 7 years world. Of a 7 years world of The Leftovers. 7 years later, how would people still be reacting? The show is interested in talking in season one about the dogs went feral, the dogs who witnessed it. They aren't our dogs anymore. They went feral. but so did the people. It has an impact on everyone, and all these things are exacerbated. You're right. It is a show about mental health, and it's funny that they're like, well, let's put the guy in the water some more. Maybe that'll fix it, because that part of it does feel, as you're saying, a little bit insensitive by today's culture of like, what do you do when someone has a mental health problem? Well, we work with them. We take care of them. We support them. What we don't do is indulge their suicide fantasies over and over again.
No.
Tell them to drink the poison and just end it, and suggest that they can go to a hotel where they'll push a child down a well and they'll be cured, magically cured.
Yeah.
So some of those things about the show hit differently, but the show itself, vibes and feeling wise, hits as good as ever.
Totally agreed. Some of my thoughts across the show have changed. Two major ones really changed on this most recent rewatch of The Leftovers, Antonio. Thing one, and it was like, I think it was like the very first thing I texted to you when I started watching, and I'm going to use an expletive because it's the final run of episodes on Post Show Recap, so I feel no way about doing this. I think I said, The Leftovers fucks from the jump. I believe is what I texted to you.
You did
something
say that.
Like that. Yeah. Yeah.
And I say, yeah. And then more than just the teenagers at that party.
And, you know, I think like in the years leading up to revisiting the show for me, when I would be asked like, oh, what should I watch or any of this? And like anytime you would get into recommending The Leftovers, you used to have to say, you got to stick through the first four episodes or so. And right around Gladys, but specifically with Guest, the first big Nora Durst episode afterwards, the show just never relents. And maybe it was the benefit of knowing that and revisiting these first few episodes for the first time in a very long time, Antonio, that made me feel more lenient towards them. But there was like some degree to which I was feeling very nostalgic, even just for the Mapleton era.
Same.
Leftovers.
Yeah, same. I loved it. And definitely consuming the audiobook, taking all that in, and revisiting some of what Tom Perlotta wrote. I really just sort of mealy-mouthed his name there. Makes me, you know, made me a little bit nostalgic anyway, right? Like revisiting some of those season one plot lines in that format. I was like, I want to see, but I also really wanted to see Kevin Garvey's Mapleton police chief outfit. I wanted to see the Guilty Remnant.
I wanted
house.
To see his jogging suit again.
I'm sure you did. You're not the only one. That is a very popular replayed moment. That's in the first episode, isn't it? Isn't it like
yes.
right away in the show? Yeah. It's like
an early impression, unique biometrics.
Talk about your mission statements. Yeah. So I wanted to see the murder of animals again personally. So yeah, we're really,
sure.
We're really all on the same page, but no, I was certainly nostalgic for it. It had great vibes meeting Nora Durst for the first time, seeing Nora Durst and Kevin together for the first time, watching their relationship start, spark and evolve. Was really so, so, so good. I even had some latitude for the Holy Wayne of it all this time through. So that was really meaningful. But I will say, like drilling it down a little bit, having watched the show all over again and then just hyper-focusing on an episode like Gladys, it's insane how much you can take away that connects to some of the larger themes of the show, some of the larger themes of season one at large, and just some of what I think The Leftovers was ultimately capital A about.
Yeah.
If you'll recall, there was an issue with episode four. I think it was an issue where there was a side story with Tommy and Christine on the bus with a soldier that when they initially wrote the episode, it was a much longer story. And Damon Lindelof had this crisis of confidence where he was like, people are going to hate this show. This is not what the show is about. I got to get rid of that. They shut production down for multiple weeks while they got the show back on track and got back to what they wanted it to be. And then we have episode five, Gladys. And then we have episode six, Guest. It's pretty clear that whenever they press that reset button, they really got it to work. So I think Gladys is a fascinating episode to look at on its own for that reason, too, because it really is the first episode after there was that big pause button pressed where they had to shut production down and reassess what they were doing.
Yeah, after an episode that you told me earlier today you think is the worst of The Leftovers, BJ and the AC.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, even compared to some of those early season one episodes that aren't as good as the rest of the run, I think BJ and the AC stands out as an episode. It's just like, what are we doing? Why are we focusing on these things? They just do a better job of bringing together the mania, the sadness, all of the things that build to that insane fiery climax at the end of season one. It's just done so much better in other episodes than what they pull off in episode four. But on the other hand, when you look at episode four as a building block, it's still good and the season is still good. It just, I think, is probably the worst episode of the last year.
What's interesting, though, to me is that even that episode, BJ and the AC, has a hallmark scene as far as I'm concerned. That's where Kevin and Nora really meet for the first time. In the school by her lockers. And this would end up being, I think it's so fascinating to me that in this episode that was the moment of crisis for Lindelof and the Leftovers production, that they needed to figure out what the show is, capital A, about. The most important part of that, the most important character set to that question, is forged in the worst episode. It's forged in the episode that causes this crisis. It's that chance hallway encounter between Kevin Garvey and Nora, who up to this point has really barely registered on the show as anything more than a local celebrity.
It's a really good point. And I think it's, look, I don't remember why specifically. We could maybe try to track it down, but I doubt we could succeed. I don't remember why we didn't record Gladys in 2014, in July of 2014. I don't remember what made us skip it, but I do know we came back right away with Guest, right? And I suspect, though can't confirm, that BJ and the AC was bad enough, because I do recall that when we first started podcasting about The Leftovers, we were taking very much a wait and see approach as to whether we were going to podcast about the whole season.
Yep.
We stopped with Gladys, or we stopped with BJ and the AC. We take Gladys off and we come back with Guest. I'd like to think, if we're going to like be apocryphal about this, I'd like to think that what happened was we didn't like episode four all that much. We then watched episode five and episode six, and we said, you know what? We're back in, baby.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was I just think that that's really interesting that these two episodes, because I do think that Gladys, it's in the title of the podcast, we should give Gladys its due. This is an episode that for me has always felt like it really is at the nexus point between when The Leftovers was quote unquote bad and when The Leftovers was quote unquote great. Guest is where great starts. BJ and the AC is where quote unquote bad ends. And Gladys is kind of the international hotel that bridges the gap between these two states of being. Even within Gladys, there's so much that I love, but so much still feels like the show is just working itself out. Everything that's going on with the Patty storyline, for instance, which I think is going to be, you know, like, you know, everything that Ann Dowd brings to the table as the show goes along speaks for itself. But I think there's something so jarring when Patty Levin is going to sit Amy Brenneman down, is going to sit Lori down in a diner. Not the first or last time Amy Brenneman will feature prominently in meetings with characters in diner scenes, Antonio. Patty brings the heat this time around.
In more ways than one.
Yes.
She brings it and drops it.
She brings the heat and she drops it off at Neil's house. that when Patty starts talking, it is very, very jarring. When you were seeing Gladys get pounded in the head with rocks, God, it's so jarring. And there's now like this like physical brutality that feels like the final, to some degree, feels like the most explosive and painful version of what those first four episodes were all about tonally, if that makes sense, because it was so grim, it was so morose, so much of those first four episodes, while the levity is absolutely there, and I think that you see a lot more of it knowing where The Leftovers goes. So much of it is what I think Lindelof sensed, like, is it too serious, blah 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 blah, and I think like the ultra violence that's leveled at Gladys is sort of like the end of that and like the segueing into this next era. All the hullabaloo about where's my white shirts? Where are my white shirts that Kevin Garvey gets into with Rohit from Mr. Robot? That kind of is I mean, in some ways that connects probably to International Assassin to some degree.
Yes,
and
yep,
an obsession
yep.
with wardrobe.
Yep.
But some of these things, like, these are not, you know, all time moments on The Leftovers, but I do feel like there's a way in which we're changing shirts. Like, we're getting rid of the mustard stain and we're putting something new on with Gladys.
Well, and I love that you described it as sort of a liminal space, this connective tissue between episode four and episode six, the bad and the good, if you will, because I think a lot of these characters are in liminal spaces, are in transition themselves. In this episode, Meg really stood out to me.
Yes.
Because Meg doesn't want to take the white. She's still talking. She maybe smokes her first cigarette ever in this episode, her first cigarette as a guilty remnant, at least. And then, of course, by the end, I'm ready now. And that all ties in to the fact that the Gladys murder, the stoning, was or was not, maybe is or isn't. I think my impression is the nod that Gladys gives Patty at the beginning, along with other elements that are present throughout the episode, suggest the guilty remnant did do this thing. It worked. 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 It worked in the small level because the liminal space and the transition that's happening with Lori is present in this one, too. Patty takes Lori to that cafe, puts those clothes on her, basically tells her she can talk, gives her that test of faith. And then Lori's blowing the whistle at Matt by the end when Matt is saying, please come out and join with me. And you think Lori's about to collapse and give in and go back to her family and go with Matt and do all these things. And she blows the whistle. Guess what? It worked. Patty's thing worked, and it worked to get the town to feel. It worked in a subtle way. I mean, the GR's whole premise, right, is that they don't want people to be able to just move on. They don't want people to be able to forget what happened when people disappeared. That was, for these people, the end of the world. Yeah. That was the thing that upended all these systems, and so they do not want people to just move on and go back to their lives and act like it didn't happen. Stop wasting your breath. Stop giving this a tribute and doing your little once a year closure mourning kind of things. It's
stop
ongoing.
Wasting my mother effing time.
Stop wasting my time, baby. Yeah. Yes. So that is all part of their plan. And that, I think, in this episode, we see that really sort of transitioning from, like, the foot goes on the accelerator. I mean, anytime you say, we're going to kill one of our members and make it look like we're being persecuted so that the town pays more attention to us, so that more people feel, and maybe I'm going to do it secretly with this member so that our own members become more committed to our cause. That is not the sort of thing you do and then don't have an impact for. And you're right. It's so brutal. I mean, Mimi Leader directed this episode.
I was just going to say, and she would go on to be the, you know, the Jack Bender of this show to Lost and have an incredible career beyond The Leftovers.
Finale. She does all three finales, and including especially this first season's one where the Gladys, the fire that consumes Gladys, and what is set in motion in last episode in BJ and the AC, and then this episode, Gladys really comes to the forefront. And the fire that Patty talks about that will eat up Lori, and the fire that we see literally eat Gladys up, and the fire that Matt talks about to Kevin when he tells him the story of Thomas and what's going to happen with the rocks that are thrown, it's going to turn into fire. That fire is a threat to consume all of Mapleton. All of our characters, Kevin, Lori, Jill, everybody at the end of this season, all at the hand of Mimi Leader. So all of that is seeded and all of it's there in this episode. And I just love that so much.
And she would direct some of the most important episodes of the show for sure. And I don't think that I'm misrepresenting that. So I remember us talking about this a lot at the time. And I think that he would only go on and talk about this more during, his segue into Watchmen. But Lindelof, his ethos here was like the writer's room does the writer's room stuff. And beyond that, he wasn't involved in the editing or anything like that. If music was in the episode that he wanted or that the writer's room wanted, it was written into the script, I believe. And as far as like who was the on set, on location leader, it was Mimi Leader. And that she was chiefly responsible. So I think, like, in the same way that you give credit, or the Royal U gives credit to Damon Lindelof for this show, there's so many people to give credit to for this show, and she is so high on that list. And I do think it's really fascinating that this move towards something greater happens here with her at the helm. Do not think that is coincidental.
I don't either. No, I definitely do not. Not just the way that she directs, like the way that the Gladys stoning is depicted, for example.
And we're moving away from like the Peter Berg action.
Yes, theatrics. I was just going to say, yeah, yes. Yeah. But also just a different show in that regard. And a show that focuses, I think, I don't know that Peter Berg directed episode of The Leftovers, for example, would have ended with the ending of this episode, which not only, I think, speaks to an expansive world that Mimi Leader really likes to examine in some of these other episodes that she does, but is just so damn brutal, man. Yes. And not brutal in the way I think that we would expect, brutal in the emotional way that Mimi Leader has such a strong touch with.
Yeah.
It just occurs to me, though, by the way, there's fire at the end of season one. There's fire at the end of season two, and she directs that, too. Like, yes, she is a cleansing fire in a lot of respects for this series.
Well, there's fire. I don't know why it happened like that.
Yeah, you walk in right into it.
There's fire at the end of season three as well. I mean, mostly the elemental force is the rain. It's a fire plus water show, right? The flood, the possible flood that's coming our way
right
by the end of The Leftovers. But the fire, Antonio, of course, is that final episode, The Book of Nora, and all things Carrie Coon. And I know that we're yada yada-ing to the best part, potentially, but I do want to just, before I forget to do this, this was the other major departure for me in watching the show again for the first time in forever. You go back and rewind the tape on our conversations about the series finale, and I think I left very little, wait for it, wiggle room for feeling like the Nora lied discourse held much weight. My feeling was, well, why would you choose not to believe her when you could choose to believe Nora? And then watching this time again, and just seeing the stacks upon stacks upon stacks of lies, mistruths, moments of dishonesty. I'm not saying that I think Nora lied, but I am saying that I got to the end this time. I was like, and it wasn't even, I think it was on the way towards the end is when I messaged you. It's like, I kind of think Nora maybe lies at the end. You know, watching those episodes with the context of the whole emotionality of the series is going to hinge on this final conversation between Nora and Kevin about something so hard to believe. And do you believe me or do you not? And she doesn't even ask that. Kevin just offers it. She says, I didn't seek you out because I didn't think you'd believe me. And he says, I believe you. You're here. Of course, I believe you. You're here. I think that the idea that he is such a believer and he is ultimately converted to this feeling of belief across the show. And did Nora ever really get there? I'm not so sure. And I think this idea of these two types of people and these two poles don't have to be in opposition, but can join hand in hand, I think really works if she's lying at the end, even though I do still want to believe her and I ultimately don't care all that much. It's just that my position on it changed a bit, and I was really surprised by that. It was a really fun experience tracking Nora's arc across the show.
I didn't change how I felt, which I think, if I remember correctly, I don't want anybody to go to the tape, but if I remember correctly, I really don't. Don't go back on anything. Yeah. But if I remember correctly, and I think my take is still, I don't care. Like, I don't care if she lied or tell the truth. I love Nora. Like Kevin, I'm willing to love Nora either in spite of or because of her dogged determination or the fact that she's a liar, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. If I might bring it back to Gladys, though, I was struck by something that Nora says to Kevin and Gladys. When Kevin, by the way, not for nothing, the fact that Kevin's looking for the all whites, he can't find his whites. Meanwhile, his wife is having no problem finding hers, taking them off, putting them on. Meg puts hers on. Kevin cannot somehow track down his whites. He's not ready. When he's trying to find the shirts and he's leaving the first time, he runs into Nora there, and Nora says to him, she says something to the effect of like, don't give in, and drop some conspiracy joking kind of stuff on him. But then she says, they'll turn up once you stop looking for them.
Yes.
And both of them agree that they don't actually believe that that's true, that they don't actually believe that if you stop looking for something, it will turn up for you. That certainly isn't what happened with Nora and Kevin, right? Kevin is turning over heaven and earth to try to find Nora. He goes to Australia every year on vacation. The globe of the United States is massive. He has no idea where Nora Durst is, but he knows where she last was, and so that's why he goes there. And he finally finds her. She turns up. It's all these years later. They both are wearing makeup and look worse than they did when they were on the show, even though Carrie Coon looks just about as good. He looks worse. They're all these years later. So if you're Kevin and you are a believer and you've been doing this thing for so long and you finally succeed and she finally turns up and this is real, this is a thing that happened, of course you're going to believe her. Yeah. Of course you're going to believe that. This is the person who told you, though, that things turn up when you stop looking for them. And I was interested in looking at when Nora does or does not go into the machine. She's not going to the machine, in my opinion, after rewatching this, because she thinks it will work.
Right.
She's going to the machine because she can't be alive anymore without her kids being in her life.
Right.
And she wants to go wherever they are, whatever that means. She's going eyes wide open when she goes into the thing, knowing that you, as one of the scientists who isn't the one from Westworld and Evil,
Gotcha Herbers,
tells her, you know, we're not guaranteeing anything. All we know is we can recreate what the environment was like when the people left. So basically, like, we're going to zap you up and there's going to be nothing left.
Her partner's whole thing of you're probably just like going to go like float in space.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever the afterlife is, you're going to it because you're not going to be alive anymore. Nora knows what the situation is. And I do think that's ultimately why she backs out. But she gives up on looking for her kids at that point. She gives up on the mission of going to be with them where they are. And I don't know what happens to Nora after that. We don't know what happens that makes Nora Sarah and that leads to her living the country cottage life in Australia. But when she does show up in our story in the Book of Nora later as Sarah and we meet her and there's that confusion at first about, okay, are we in a different dimension? Is she lying? Like, what's happening here? And then, of course, it's just a put on because she doesn't really want to bring Kevin back into her life and then ultimately does. It's different. Like, she has stopped looking for her children. Is she happy? Like, have they turned up? Does she find her family? Does she find the completeness that she was looking for once she stopped looking for her? I don't know. Kevin does not stop looking for his shirts. He goes in and bullies the guy to giving him shirts that might not even be his. I still don't think that's very clear in Gladys. Yeah. So I don't know that that helps him in any way whatsoever. But I do think that if Nora doesn't go into the machine and she does, you know, leave and pulls the plug right before they zap her up, I do think there's a world where that is her giving up on looking for her children. And so then ultimately what turns up once she is stopped, perhaps completeness, perhaps a family again when Kevin comes back.
Yeah,
that's the part I'm not sure of, but I thought that line was very interesting because neither of them believed it.
No, not at all. I think that the ways in which this was a big piece for me was just even the earliest stuff, the stuff that could be kind of discounted as, you know, you could tell someone, just start with season two, which I think would be doing the show and your overall enjoyment of it a humongous disservice. That I think that even these first few episodes have the seeds of the best moments of the show firmly planted into the ground. Also, you would end up missing out on one of the still, this was a feeling that I'd had that I felt very deeply remembering that I felt this way when we were talking about it in the real time of season two, but felt it so powerfully again this time that if you missed out on season one, then the like powerhouse nightmare fuel that is Liv Tyler's season two performance would be completely lost on you, I think. To watch Meg's transformation, Antonio, was one of the creepiest joys of this rewatch for me.
Absolutely. Unquestionably. That
like
really
unhinged performance.
Off
the
screen
like, for me. This is the Joker. This is like full, like unhinged Joker, Liv Tyler.
No doubt. Some men like to watch the world burn, and some women like to kidnap you, throw you in the back of a truck, and sexually assault you. It could go either way.
Yeah.
She's insane.
A school bus of children and throw an empty grenade in it.
A fake grenade and then walk away like the Joker would. Yes. But it's so great to see her in Gladys. Like I said, this is such a huge episode for her. And that character who has been chopping down trees and blistering her hands up and not sure why she's doing what she's doing. When we first meet her, she's not even at the house.
Yeah.
So for her to be what she is by the end of the series, and certainly by the end of season two, but especially by the end of seasons two and three, when we really get the full picture of what this character was, and we know everything about where she goes and what happens to the Guilty Remnant and her version of it there in Jardin, it's fascinating to see her in Gladys, for example, like I said, smoking her first cigarette, yeah. Taking the first vow of silence, saying, "I'm ready now,"
yeah.
And not being scared. When one of the I don't know if it's the last thing she ever says as far as like and not talking after this. I don't think it is because I think she talks to Laurie later, maybe. I can't remember. But she says to Kevin, like, she's not your wife anymore.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa, this is not the same Meg. Like, already not the same Meg. That's the Meg we know from the rest of the show. It was a real treat to rewatch Meg's arc and then to see it in a small way in this episode.
It happens a lot faster than I'd remembered. That really, and again, you know, this is something that, so, you know, rewatching a bit of the show today after having rewatched the show, I did not, in my initial return to season one, remember the entirety of Meg's story. So I had forgotten what had happened to her the day before the departure and the way that gets dramatized in season two, episode nine.
Lines.
Yeah, when you see that she loses her mother the day before and nobody thinks about it ever again because the great departure happens the next day. And so watching her today in Gladys on the other side of revisiting her season two contributions really makes me understand the menace and the hurt and the depths of the pain. And I think Liv Tyler is probably somebody that even we didn't give a ton of credit to at the time would be my guess. But going back and rewatching her, it's so easy to, you know, talk about Carrie Coon being a queen, which she is, or Justin Theroux being a king, which he is, or Regina being a king, which she is too. But I think we're not going to give enough kudos to Liv Tyler when we're talking about The Leftovers anymore, or Ann Dowd, right? You know, I Ann Dowd, obviously, but I think that Meg is sort of the secret sauce of season two for me, alongside, you know, it's not her who's the only one who does like the really scary evil turn. There's everything. Evie Murphy in season two and going and like knowing that her whole deal is going to be that she is like training to be a Guilty Remnant. That's why they're running naked through the woods. This is why they don't talk in the car, like going back and revisiting all of that. Really, really brilliantly done. And Jasmine Savoy Brown has just gone on to have a really fun career as well. I don't think that you do the Yellow Jackets, Antonio.
I do. I gave up. But yeah, I'm familiar. I gave up before the end of season two.
Yeah. So between that, Scream, like she's had a lot of really cool stuff going on too. So
yeah, it's great. I just went to my browser and typed in Liv Tyler and it's highlighted in purple because I looked it up a few days ago.
Yeah.
What has Liv Tyler been like doing? I want to see more Liv Tyler in things like The Leftovers because she was so good on this show.
She has a couple of shows that she's been in, right? But
I
haven't heard much about it.
No, and it's sort of like maybe it's on me. Maybe it's that I didn't pick up like what, you know, perhaps I was unfamiliar with your work. So like it's probably on me, but I just feel like after rewatching The Leftovers, like maybe Liv Tyler is very choosy and picks what she wants to do. And so, you know, when she goes and does like the shows that she's done or the project she's done, it's really what she wants to do. But man, I'd watch Liv Tyler do something like this Meg Abbott role again. But again, these roles don't come along all the time, which again speaks to the power and brilliance of this show. Like it was a good role because of Liv Tyler, but it was a great role for Liv Tyler. And there need to be more roles like that. It's just a fantastic show.
I think there's probably some people looking at their phones right now and shouting, "Harlots!"
watch Harlots because she's in 16 episodes of two of the three seasons of Harlots, which I know a lot of people really loved. The state of TV now versus where it was when we were talking about The Leftovers in 2014, Antonio. That's wild is like so overused, but it's wild. It's a killer ride.
I'm thinking now, that's perfect. That's a 2014 reference right there. I'm thinking, because I'm sure I told that story then. I'm thinking we need to do in God willing, knock on wood, in the year of our Lord 2034, we should come back again in 10 years and podcast about The Leftovers again.
Okay.
Because there are, it is an interesting way to like lens, another Leftovers episode title, the world we live in. The Leftovers is a byproduct, right, of the series of books and discussions about the rapture that were so popular in the 80s and 90s. And the book is written, I think, in response to that. It's sort of like, okay, this isn't left behind because there's not going to be the religious angle, but I'm most interested in really examining the way that a departure like this would impact on the micro and macro levels, whether it's an individual person living in Mapleton, whether it's a small town like Mapleton, whether it's the world at large, like we see in Guest a little bit, or in It's a Matt World, or some of the things that we experience when we go into Australia. Good day, mate. It's a show that I think is a very interesting way to look at the world. Of course, in 2024, we are still in the midst of diseases going around that were pandemic status, that might still be pandemic status, but we started ignoring the stats and we don't even know. Like, we experienced a thing, Josh, where people were just disappearing. I still remember, I think it's called Hart's Island in New York City, seeing like photographs of the mass burials of bodies during COVID that looked a lot like what we saw at this, the FBI or the ATF Forensic Center, where we see all these bodies wrapped up and just being incinerated one by one by people in hazmat suits.
Yeah.
Like, is so evocative of a time and place that we lived through, where we were finding out what celebrity got COVID, what celebrity had died from COVID. When Kevin Garvey's watching this on TV 3 years after the departure, it's just like, okay, like this is hitting a little too close to home. So I can't wait to see in 10 years what will have happened that will get us to look at The Leftovers differently. But if you haven't revisited it since the COVID era started, it's certainly interesting to do in light of that.
Yeah, for sure. What are some of your other takeaways on the menu when it comes to the Leftovers, things that you picked up along the rewatch way?
Well, and I still want to talk about Gladys because I do think that these two things are part and parcel.
Let's lend it to Gladys. Let's do Gladys some justice. Her name was Gladys.
Her name was Gladys Paulson.
Yeah.
Yes, her name was Robert Paulson. That's why I started to say, and then I realized it wouldn't be appropriate. Kevin's white shirts. You brought this up. But it's anytime you've got Kevin Garvey looking into a closet and his clothes are there on a hanger and he's deciding which one to pick out and wear, you have to ask yourself, does he know himself? Is he attiring himself accordingly? Like, is this the right way to dress? Of course, in the context of Gladys, if you're watching it for the first time, the stuff with Kevin's disappearing shirts, the alarm going off, not going off, being set, not being set, it's all presented in the same world that has the missing bagel in the bagel machine. It's getting a little annoying. It's getting a little old. We get it. Kevin Garvey is cracking up. He's losing his mind. Things are not going well for him. Maybe it's just like his father. We don't know. We don't exactly know what, but the stuff with the missing shirts, when you only have seen the first four episodes, it plays like, okay, Kevin's shirts are missing.
Right.
Maybe if you've seen the first season, you're like, hey, wait, those were white shirts, just like the Guilty Remnant wore. And Kevin had kind of a breakdown and a panic attack in this episode. So did his wife. So did Lori. And so did his daughter. So did Jill. By the end of the series, all three of them are in the yard of the Guilty Remnant house while it's on fire. Do they all need to be cleansed? Is this all connected? And what will they all carry with them throughout the course of the series that was sort of hinted at in Gladys? So Kevin's shirts aren't just Kevin's shirts to me. They're representative of the path he could have taken. They're representative of a path he could have taken in season two. And they're representative of a path that his wife affirmatively did take and then rejects, that his daughter tries on for size at the end of this season. So it's not just a white shirt. It's never just going to be a white shirt when it's Kevin Garvey and it's The Leftovers. So that part really jumped out to me. I was like, wow, okay, they're really leaning in on this. I like that.
still feels like they didn't do enough, especially like going on to see what Margaret Qualley was capable of.
Right.
Not quite enough done with Jill.
Yeah, they couldn't really figure that out or thread the needle. She has to be sort of our way in to the way the youth, in quotes, are experiencing the departure.
Right.
And how they're processing it.
How does iChoke hold up 10 years later? I think they're still out there doing it.
Oh, yeah. Holds up fantastically. And both you and I thought the kid that she iChokes with was Jeremy Allen White.
I was convinced. I rewound it. I kept looking. I was like, that's definitely Jeremy Allen White. That's Farmy for sure. Cousin, what are you doing? No kinship.
Cousin.
and then, of course, no, it's absolutely not Jeremy Allen.
No, but you see the character pop up a couple more times in the show, and you're like, hey, that's the guy. He's at the Viking funeral. Oh, he's at the fridge. He's at the fridge scene. That's the guy that I told you about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she was sort of hamstrung by having to be the lens in which we were able to view what these terrible kids were up to at that time. So that part's difficult for her. And then it's difficult for her in season two as well. She has to kind of watch out for a baby because everyone else that lives in her house is freaking nuts, you know, is the best way to put it, maybe. Or, you know, her surrogate mother, who she barely knows, is buying houses for $3 million and throwing rocks through her neighbor's windows out of just pure guilty remnant-like anger. And, you know, of course, her father, he has to be handcuffed to the freaking bed because he's walking around at night. The neighbors are disappearing. Jill, poor Jill, she just has to sit back and deal with all this. And I think the show, by the time season three starts, says, you know what, enough is enough. Let's stop doing Jill Garvey being miserable. Let's let her go. Let's send her to college.
I do love that, like, they just bring her back in season three specifically to do that. They're like,
yep,
you are released from your prison. You do not have to be here anymore.
Yep. And she and Tommy are having a happy time reminiscing when their mom calls them right before she does or does not take her own life in the scuba tank.
Oh, gosh.
So, yeah, another part that we didn't love, right?
Oh, you know, it's just.
But I really like that we've got that there. And if you want a Jill Garvey summary, it comes from Amy and Gladys. Kevin says, is she okay? She's Jill. She doesn't really do okay, you know? And it's just like, God, I feel so terrible for her. Both she and Kevin are, they didn't lose anybody, right, directly. But they're so upset about having lost Lori. And just the way that is impacting the two of them, that when Kevin shows up at the school, Jill just bursts into tears. She just assumed her mother's dead. Yeah. And, you know, when Kevin is dealing with what he's dealing with.
That's so dark.
So dark. It's so dark and it's so upsetting. And like I said, it really, the fact that all three Garveys that we saw in this episode all had their moment like that in this episode, I think only served to underscore what all three of them collectively were going through, even as each of them were going through it individually without one another. The going through it individually without one another was part of the pain. Like, they didn't want to be vulnerable to each other because, Kevin needed to be strong for Jill. So when he's crying on the bed at the end and finally admits to himself and probably to her that they are getting divorced, that's when he breaks down. You know, before that, he can't even say to his daughter, are you okay? He has to ask her friend. So the three of them really need to come back together. They really need one another. And I love that that's delivered on in the way that it is in the finale with Lori screaming in season one, Jill's inside, you know, and then Kevin going to get her and how that all plays out. I really, really like that. And so seeing Jill in this episode, the way that we saw her was really so fantastic and so sad, just so sad. And you're right. We could have done more with the character.
Yeah.
Speaking of could have done more, I'd like you to know what your take on this is. I texted this to you at some point and you said only if people had watched. I just said they could have made The Leftovers the show forever because the world it's set in is so interesting and the world at large. I'm just still so fascinated by the agent plot in Gladys, by the ATF agent who can barely return Kevin's call, who doesn't even know when Kevin's the police chief who called him and said, I'm going to come down there and yelled at him. He doesn't even really remember. You did that.
Yeah, and then when he's on the phone, he sounds like he's trying to extort Jesse Gemstone for money, right? Like, you know, like, this is a man with the voice of the devil. All of a sudden, he's like, this could all go away. It's like, whoa, you know,
what's going on here?
Yeah, we forgot the Leftovers episode where he shows up later pretending to be a friend of Jill's, this agent. Yep. And then just hangs around for a while. And then, yeah, all of that ensues. No, you're right. He is a scary voice. It's an intimidating voice. And he's talking about like, oh, what was that one again? You know, was that a Children of God? Was that? And he goes, Guilty Remnant. Well, hey, what is it with the? So in other words, that what you're getting through this character and what you're getting when we eventually go to the ATF Forensic Center and we see just body after body wrapped up and being burned is that there are a lot of fucked up things. I say fuck too. A lot of fucked up things that have popped up in the aftermath of this, of the departure, such that the ATF has these dedicated bureaucratic arms to deal with all these things. And it's literally an assembly line of dead bodies just being burned up one by one. And it's just like, wow, when they say they're going to go into these houses and exterminate them, like they really are. This is the world we live in. A fascinating glance. Of course, we get so much more of this next episode when we get into Guest and Nora goes to her conference and we start to find out about the dolls that people have made or the other attendant services that are being offered for grief, and just how all of these things can kind of come together in the same bullshit, boring corporate way that we do just about any kind of product or commodity. The departure has been commoditized, and we've got protesters out front of that commodity world and fake grenades being handed out. I mean, the world of the Leftovers is so rich, and I just feel like maybe we don't get to deliver on everything we could have throughout the course of the show.
It feels it definitely felt, because it is, it's only 27, 28 episodes?
Yeah, 28, I think, right? Two tens and an eight?
I think that's right. So it's a short journey. We go in and out of it really quickly. And I felt that, I mean, like we said, we started watching it a week and a half ago, and we finished it with five bonus episodes to spare and an audiobook in your case. And I think that I felt the speed of the plot. Like there's everything that goes down between seasons two and three that I would have been fascinated to see. Like, how do John and Lori get together? How do John and Lori, like, what do John and Lori like find in common with one another when she is so against the Book of Kevin and the entirety of their relationship? You assume he's working on writing it. You know, so there's just a lot that I would have loved to have seen there. There's just a lot of different aspects of the characters and their stories that I would have loved to have seen. But I think you're absolutely right in terms of the greater world of the show. But I also think to some extent, you know, I think you seized upon this too, that there is this, you know, prophetic vibe to the Leftovers that plays very differently in the COVID universe. In the world of 2024 versus 2014, the Leftovers, there are ways in which it plays really harshly. There are other ways in which I think it makes you feel seen in a way that probably was absolutely, you know, the case in 2014, but I think is so like on such a mass wide level is experienced now totally differently than it was when the show came out. This was a thing we texted about too, is the way in which Watchmen came out and George Floyd was murdered like 6 months later. Just like some of the ways in which these Lindelof shows show up and then what happens after that totally recontextualize the viewing experience.
Yes, I texted my wonderful mother-in-law that I finally, for the first time rewatching it, I was like, I get it. I get the Guilty Remnant. Like, I want in.
Yeah,
I don't want people to just think that we can move on and act like everything is fine when people died, when my guy John Prine died of COVID, for fuck's sake. Like, I don't want people to just act like it wasn't a thing or forget about it or do once a year celebrations on COVID day. Like this is a mass trauma that all of us experience together. And many of us continue to experience as, you know, throughout the next couple of years. So I see what the Guilty Remnant's point is. Like, I don't like the idea that you can just pretend nothing happened or pretend it was wrong when it did happen. I don't want to go back to that because of all that was invested in processing it for the first time. So I get it. I get the guilty remnant for the first time. And I'm not sure I could give up talking or pick up smoking.
I'm pretty sure you couldn't give up talking.
I'm pretty sure I couldn't either. And I'm pretty sure that's what you told me when I texted you, that I get the guilty remnant now. And I'm pretty sure you're right.
Yeah.
So that's totally fine. How about we'll do like the less guilty remnant? We'll do like the moderately guilty remnant. I'll wear white and I'll stand outside and troll people at their places of work. I'll troll the deniers or the anti-vaxxers where they live. And I'll smoke cigarettes, but I'll also talk to them.
Sure. Yeah. But I'll also tell them like with my words.
Yeah.
What
yes. Wrong. Yeah. The moderately chuffed remnant. I don't know. I don't know what the word is.
Chuffed remnant?
Yeah. I don't know what the word is. I can't come up with it. You know, yes.
The not guilty until proven.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. The Alford plea remnant. Yeah. Right. I'm just going to go with the mildly embarrassed remnant.
I think the mildly chuffed is where I want.
I don't want to tell you who I think the Patty Levin of COVID is. So we're just going to leave.
Oh, shit. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
But I do hope for the same ending.
Okay. Fair enough. Did anything hit you differently about Ghost World and the hotel and the Patty Levin of it all? Patty, this is her first big speaky episode. Again,
would love to speak about Gladys, the character again. Gladys has a great role in International Assassin.
Yes.
She is talking more than she ever talks on the show, of course. And she is Patty's chief of staff / security.
Mike Novick to Patty's David Palmer.
Exactly. Yes. Or perhaps the Leo McGarry to Patty's Jed.
Oh, man.
We don't know.
Things that have changed since 2014 is that I've now watched all of The West Wing.
Yes.
And fully understand
you are on
who
the other
and
side.
What a Leo McGarry is.
Yes.
And let Patty be Patty. Is my favorite character on The West Wing.
Oh, man. Wow. Strong take, but I can't disagree. Let Levin be Levin. Yeah, I don't know. I don't. Gladys is there and she plays that role there. And it's fun. Of course, this is a very memorable character to see her in that way. I love that about International Assassin. I'm like, okay, so I'm rewatching this in part because I want to talk about Gladys the episode. I'll talk about Gladys the episode. I want to talk about Gladys the character. Here is Gladys the character being served up to me in Kevin's hotel. This is fantastic. And of course, she's there. She's dead. She's dead, perhaps by choice. So, although not without regret, Gladys, of course, also pops up again on The Leftovers when we have, I think that is season 2, episode 9. Is that the Garveys at their best? Yes. I can't remember when it is. When it is, we find out that she was a dog breeder that Lori was meeting with about adopting a dog that Kevin didn't even want. And that was what Gladys did in the events right up to the departure. She was a dog breeder. So the fact that dogs play such an interesting role in the first season of The Leftovers, especially, and are represented as a totem, if you will, in season 3 when the BBA does show back up with that sandwich and talking about DNA. And we see what the insanity of the dogs has done to him at that point. Gladys being the dog breeder or somebody who is responsible for these animals. It's fascinating to think about when you think about what the dogs do on the show and what Gladys does on the show. So I love seeing her show up in International Assassin. And I love seeing that, like I said, the DNA of this episode in that episode is pure. And I absolutely love that. So that was great. I really, really liked doing that when we rewatched it, seeing Gladys as we walked through. I should also note one of the other things about Gladys is that, you know, of course, the dogs go crazy and so does Gladys. She's also, Josh, I was trying to come up with this when I thought about it. Other than Kevin Garvey himself, mm-hmm. She's one of the few characters in The Leftovers and Patty Levin, I think, to be killed twice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She's killed, of course, in this episode, and then she's killed again when Kevin shoots her in the head in International Assassin. No rocks for her.
I also think that Kevin gets killed a bunch. I think
that's what I said. Kevin's one of the few to be killed more than once, for sure.
Yeah, he gets killed. He gets killed multiple. He gets killed twice in season 2.
Yeah,
he gets killed twice in season 3, episode
7.
Yep.
7 Kevin.
That Rob and Akiva were no. Then within that episode, he kills his brother, his twin brother, right?
Oh,
I
wanted to talk to you about that too, but I'm not even sure we've got the time.
He digs the pacemaker out. So Kevin Garvey dies 5 times?
He dies at least five times. Yeah. At least five times. Yeah. Kevin Garvey dies at least five times. And I don't know if we count the him putting the bag on his head with the tape.
No, because he didn't go there. At least we didn't see if he went there or not.
And I don't know if we count him tying a rock to his foot and jumping into the Jordan or Miracle, whatever that is, lake, brook, stream, creek.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if we count that one. We don't know. I mean, there was an earthquake that apparently saved him. But yeah, we got that. It stood out to me. I was like, hey, Gladys dies more than once on the show. And that is kind of a rarefied air. Rarefied air.
Yeah.
I think that the guy who plays God, quote unquote, who Matt is, that's the guy Matt was telling us about.
What is it? Dave Burton is the
Dave
character?
Burton. Yeah. He gets killed by the lion.
yeah.
He also, I think, doesn't Kevin like throw the rope around his neck and throw him off the bridge?
No, he walks away from him. He walks throws away the rope around Kevin and he's going to lead him out. And then like they talk it through more and God
that's right.
Can go. Yeah.
So I can't remember if David Burton dies more than once on the show, but he dies at least once. And the fact that he's always there in the International Assassin, you know, talk about liminal spaces, that hotel would seem to suggest that the man is in a constant state of dead and alive. And maybe there's more to his stories than he would, than Matt would really be able to comfortably deal with on the top of that boat there. Yeah. So I don't know. But Gladys is one of the few, the queen of nods. I also noticed in this rewatch as we're leading up to it, I think it's in episode 2. We see a lot of the guilty remnant throughout being harassed by strangers, right? People shouting at them. Matt, of course, in episode 3 of season 1 gets hit with a rock because he's there to help somebody else who got hit with the rock that was a guilty remnant people. So they're getting hit with rocks. They're being harassed. At one point when Gladys is painting a building white, she has red paint thrown all over her. And the camera lingers as she sort of just takes it in. And I thought to myself in episode 2, when Gladys has that red paint thrown on her and she looks bloodied up just like she looks later, and she has a pause and she thinks about it. Is that when she thought, you know what? I'm done with this. We're just going to do this false flag.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I couldn't quite track that. Some of the Patty stuff still does not. I mean, the Patty stuff maybe plays better for me if I just take her as a lunatic or as, you know, like a really troubled person. Who, you know, shits in a bag and leaves it on her husband's doorstep, Billy Madison style. But the
called the shit poop.
It's that flaming bag of poop again. I don't know. I think to say that she has some kind of master plan or anything like that, it's hard for me to see. I don't know that the needle moved on Patty all that much for me in the rewatch, other than just like really appreciating Ann Dowd and, you know, for how horribly difficult the show is to watch Handmaid's Tale, just how great Ann Dowd is on that show and how happy I am that I think The Leftovers gatewayed her into like a wider popular consciousness, yes, which is a very deserved thing.
Without a doubt, for sure. I can't really tell you if I feel like there is a method to Patty's madness as far as like, is it just madness? Obviously, I think the false flag, if you want to call it that, it's effective, brutally effective, but effective. And like I said, I think you see that play out in this episode. I tend to ascribe a lot more deviousness to Patty, that it isn't just madness. So that, for example, when we go to the forest and Kevin's like, all right, I'm going to tell you guys to get off the street, but I know you're not gonna. And Patty's like, of course. It's like, oh, wait a minute. She knew that Kevin was going to say that. And this is a zig when you think someone's going to zag thing. And then, of course, this is all just part of her plan. Kevin says, I want a curfew. And she knows that Kevin will want a curfew because of Lori being there and Lori being around, Lori being special. And so Kevin's the one who says the town feels the response. Like the town really isn't concerned, Kevin, that the guilty remnant got killed. In fact, most of the people there, we see that random dude walk up and be like, don't investigate it too hard. Okay. Yeah. Calling them Moonies, you know, which was like, a thing people remember from airports back in the day, some of the early people that were seen to be cultists, that were religious fanatics, that people would run into. So this is like the town's response. So guilty remnant gets killed, big deal. Obviously, the people that know the GR people are upset. But the GR's whole point was the town to feel they wanted these people to feel. They did not want them to forget. They want them to indulge in the feelings that are present when you think about the departure. That's why they troll people the way they do. That's why they bring the dolls into people's homes. They don't want people to forget. So the fact that people will feel the response and don't want the curfew, all part of the plan.
It's all part of the plan.
Yeah. So she's a little bit of a joker, just like Meg. Is she completely insane? Is there a method to her madness? It's hard to say. And I don't think on a rewatch I gleaned any more as far as that goes. But I still think, like you, that Ann Dowd, fantastic, and deserves all the flowers she could get. And I really like her in Gladys specifically, because she's doing all the talking at that diner there. It's just such a powerful scene. I understand the pull. I understand your family, your past. I understand that going back to them feels comfortable and easy because the alternative, what we do, is very, very hard. But there can't be any doubt, Lori, because doubt is fire, and fire is going to burn you up until you are but ash. So good. So good. I
and
love
this woman
doubt
decided
so
not
much.
To speak, you know, like, gosh. Yep.
Yeah. We're what a crime. Like, we're lost. Yeah. And the fire thing, like I said, whether doubt is the fire or whether fire burns people up because they are but ash, and whether all the cleansing fires that we see on the show are a product of doubt or are a product of people who have no doubt in their mind and are brutally insane or whatever word you want to use, I don't know. But the fire metaphor is present not just in this episode, not just in this season, but in the many seasons of The Leftovers. It is a cleansing thing. It's the thing that brings upon the rain. When Kevin sets the Book of Kevin on fire in the hotel room in that horrible fight with Nora. The fire metaphor and Patty having it so present and so top of mind until you are but ash remains so memorable to me. And so to see it be such a significant part of this episode for a long time, Josh, I think what I said in my mind to people that were asking about The Leftovers is, if you don't like it by guest, you're not going to like it. But I kind of now feel like if you aren't feeling it or getting it by Gladys, I'm not sure you are going to feel it or get it.
Interesting. Yeah, I think I agree. But I think how I would amend it is, just watch it. It's 28 episodes. Make sure you're in a good headspace. Don't watch this if you're in a really bad one. But watch it at some point. Watch it. If you consume this kind of TV, if you're always looking for the next show and you have not yet put the 28 episodes of The Leftovers into your life, do that. Absolutely do that. You know, no spoilers here, but Grace and Mike have been counting down the best TV shows of all, not of all time, but of the last 10 years as part of our post-show recap sign-off. Leftovers represent, you know, and there is a reason all these years later. And I do think when, you know, 10 years from now, whether or not we're going to do another Leftovers podcast 10 years from now, Antonio, when I think back on what we did here, what we made here on post-show recaps, so much of that is going, I think that The Leftovers will be the first show that comes to mind for me. The Leftovers, to me, is post-show recaps in a very significant way. I think it gave us a platform to talk about the stories that we love and the TV that we love and this hobby that we all enjoy with a level of depth and community that I had not up until that point found anywhere, let alone on a podcast and online. And I think that, you know, we've had some hits, we've had some misses along the way. The landscape is huge and juicy right now, to the point that maybe it's just a little too huge and juicy. And we're closing up the shop and moving on to new projects and new endeavors and new things. But I feel like when I think back on this time, when I think back on the 10-year stretch that was post-show recaps and the 10 years that elapsed between that July 2014 date that we theoretically recorded Gladys and this time that we're recording March 2024, I think when I'm going to be thinking about what are the shows that come to mind, I'm going to be thinking in my mind's eye, I'm going to see Nora crying and the water, you know, the sprinklers just like in the hotel hosing the tears down onto the ground. I'm going to be thinking about that wide shot of Kevin pushing poor young Patty down the well. I'm going to be thinking of Homeward Bound. Like, I'm going to be thinking of The Leftovers. I'm going to be thinking of Gladys for sure. For that, I am deeply, deeply grateful.
I couldn't have said it better myself, and I feel the same way. And it's a little, wouldn't say daunting. It's a privilege that a lot of other people, I think, also associate post-show recaps when they see the words or hear of it. They think of The Leftovers, that they think of our podcasts, and that they think of the conversations that we shared with them about this show. I was thinking about a lot in the lead up to this, thinking about people like Dominic Malpieti, who was such a great person, provide feedback on our podcast. And I know was committed to all of our Leftovers podcasting. And just think about the listeners that we've interacted with, that we've become friends with, that we've podcasted with, that we've spent time with together over the years. And of course, you and I, Josh, you said there were some hits, there were some misses. I acquired a misses. You were the officiant.
I was.
That is all a product of our podcasting about the stupid strain and the smart Leftovers.
And I absolutely closed out the wedding ceremony with your marriage. This wedding is over, but your marriage is just getting started.
You did do that.
You will be haunted by post-show recaps for the rest of your life.
It's true. It's a good ghost, though. It's a good ghost. It's a holy ghost.
Yeah,
no, no problems there whatsoever. It's a good ghost. And I'm happy to have it. And it's wearing all white, like a classic ghost would. And not in the scary way, in the all white way, like they do in Indiana, Kentucky, Missouri.
Uh-huh.
We like this. We like this.
We're fans.
You're right. You maybe want to give yourself the headspace and the time to rewatch The Leftovers, but I just think it's a show that, like I said, we could podcast it about it in 10 years, and I'm sure we would take new things from it. And some people say that about great literature, that you could read the book when you were 13, 23, 33, 43, 53, and it would hit differently and mean something different to you at all those stages of your life. I suspect The Leftovers is like that as well.
Yeah, for sure. Uncle Tonio, what do we got? Anything else?
I just ate a really big meal. May I be excused?
Thinking about how that line you were quoting from Patty and how she speaks so fervently and intensely to Lori, that entire time she just has to make.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it's coming. Train's coming.
You know, train's coming in, pulling in. Storm's coming, Annie.
Make better than make flowers, which is what she does on True Detective, which we don't need to talk.
Correct.
About.
Forgot about that. Now I remember.
Remembered about that. Just like post-show recaps, Josh, it was my endeavor. I will endeavor to make sure you never forget that.
I never will. We will never forget any of you. Antonio and I, the future holds great things for us. You will find out about whatever we've got going on. I'm sure we will, you know, post in our various podcast feeds. We still have access to all of that stuff. So if Antonio and I ever pick up the microphone again, and it is hard to imagine that we won't find some way to do exactly that, you'll hear from us if you stay subscribed to the Leftovers feed, Mr. Robot, Ted Lasso, Better Call Saul. We'll make sure that we sound the horn for sure.
Yeah, and follow Josh on social media, because with each passing month, I'll have less and less of it.
Well, I'm on there. I'm not really using it all that much, but I am, of the two of us, probably the one to contact on social media. He is at AC Mazzaro, 2Z1R, wherever you can find him.
Yeah,
and I'm at Round Howard. I'm at Round Howard still, all these years later, wherever you can find me. So if Antonio and I have another project in the hopper, you'll hear it there for sure. You'll hear it in all these various feeds. But I think that's it. We say goodbye to July 2014. We say goodbye to March 2024. And we say goodbye to post-show recaps.
Yeah, we're here now. And that's all that matters.
That's right. Do you believe us?
I do.
I hope so. Because we believe you. Do we?
I don't believe everybody that's listening. I know too much about people to know that I don't believe everyone who is listening to this. But I believe in you, Josh, and I believe in us, and we will always be here.
All right. Well, post-show recaps is over, and I'm just getting started hitting the stop recording button. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.